start using cutting-edge Warp Speed 5G technology with your cell phone. Let me tell you about my friends at mobilemobile.io. They have an ultra-fast 4G LTE and 5G network that covers 99% of Americans. So they've got you covered everywhere. Think about it for a moment. You have the opportunity to take a test drive for 10 days with unlimited talk, text, and premium data. What is premium data? Premium data is an allotment of a cellular data that you receive from a higher priority on the network. You won't get throttled like you will with some of those, well,
non-brand
service providers. To find out more information, all you have to do is go to mobilemobile.io. That's mobilemobile.io to start your 10-day free trial.
This show is brought to you by Safety FM. The Jay Allen Show is streaming now on safetyfm.live.
Hello and welcome to the Jay Allen Show. Today's Tuesday, July the 21st of 2020. I hope all is well in your neck of the woods. We are streaming live from the Safety FM studios in Orlando, Florida. So let me tell you of what we have going on today. Today we have a conversation with Sydney Decker. Sydney Decker is a professor and a director of Safety Science Innovation Lab at Griffith University in Australia, and a professor at the Faculty of Aerospace Engineering in the Netherlands. Sydney has lived and worked in 7 countries across 4 continents and won worldwide acclaim for his groundbreaking work in human factors and safety. He coined the term safety differently back in 2012, which has since turned into a global movement for change. It encourages organizations to declutter their bureaucracy and set people free to make things go well, and to offer compassion, restoration, learning when they don't. An avid pilot of planes, large and small, he has been flying a Boeing 737 as an airline pilot on the side. Sydney's best-selling author for most recently, Foundations of Safety Science, The Safety Anarchist, The End of Heaven, Just Culture, Safety Differently, The Field Guide to Understanding Human Error, Second Victim, Drift into Failure, and Patient Safety. He has directed the documentaries Safety Differently in 2017, Just Culture in 2018, The Complexity of Failure in 2018, and Doing Safety Differently in 2019. His work has over 12,200 citations and an H index of 47. It is my pleasure to welcome Sydney Decker to this limited commercial episode of the Jay Allen Show. Sydney, welcome to the show. So let's just start off from the very beginning. I always like to start off the conversation with what got you to fall in love with safety. Why did you decide to dedicate, your whole career to it at this point?
It sounds like I fell in love with safety, Jay.
Well, you had to. If you've been doing it for such a long period of time, there's no way that you can't have some levels of love into it.
There's all kinds of ways to look at that. One is a really cynical one. Let's start off there then. a good grizzly old friend of mine said at some point early in career, if that's what you want to call it. He said, the problem is the more you have done, the less you can do. And I sort of found that super depressing, but quite accurate, because the more you've done of a certain thing, the more people associate you with it, the more of it is on your resume, the more people are willing to give you jobs associated with that sort of thing and not with anything else. And so there seems to be a truth to this. I fell in love with flying. I fell in love with aviation first. And so that happened when I was 3 years old. And my parents actually didn't have a television, right? I was uh, I grew up in the 70s, no television. But my grandma had a television.
I'm going to say for the 70s, that's kind of late for not having a TV. I'm just throwing that out there. I'm not trying to be judging.
This is the Netherlands. It's a little bit, but it's okay. And at some point it did show up in my life. I must have been a teenager by then, but I never, and we're on radio. We're not, or other media, not television here either. So I watched a program. I was 3 years old watching this program at my grandparents and my grandma's, and she had on something that was about flying and in the mountains, and I went, oh my word, it just made such an impression that I decided this is something that I would really love to do. And so as soon as I was legal age to go fly, which is 14 for flying gliders, I did solo, started flying. And then, interestingly, I out of school into uni, and already pretty early on, I started studying psychology, as my major. And I found a way to combine the interest in psychology and human performance with flying. And so there's aviation psychology. It turns out to be an entire field. And so so then I try to specialize in that. And I go to Dave Woods at Ohio State after I got a couple of masters to get my PhD. And so the first thing that I learned there is that all the colleagues in the lab at Dave Woods are writing a really cool book on going behind the label of human error. And so what can we find behind this label of human error? And I found it super fascinating. And of course, as you probably know, I think about 15 years or 20 years later, I redid the version of that book, Behind Human Error, with Dave and his colleagues, to update it and get it published beyond the Air Force publication that they had at the time. So then you sort of tumble into this and the combination of psychology on the one hand and, of course, engineering on the other, and how to build stuff so people don't get invitations to screw things up. was the motor, the engine behind the engagement with safety. But interestingly, Jay, I think it's only in the last 10 years, and I'm going to tell you why, that I got engaged with what we would term workplace safety or hard hat safety, because all of the work before then was in sexy high-tech worlds, high-tech healthcare stuff, high-tech aviation stuff, fast jets. I was working with Saab in Sweden building fighter jets. Well, I wasn't building fighter jets.
I was going to say, hold on here. There's more to the story.
Were you building fighter jets? No, I was not building fighter jets. With British Aerospace in the UK, and they were building fighter jets. And so it was all, it was sort of the, literally the pointy nose end of safety with domains that do relatively high-end safety stuff. And at some point, I made flying into the career as well on the side, which happened when I got hired by Lund University in Sweden as a professor and a dean. And I had the opportunity to get type rating on the 737 and get all my other ratings up.
Well, I'm going to have to ask you that. How do you create extra time? There has to be a secret to it. You can't be doing all of this work and all of a sudden create a secondary career. I mean, the way that you manage.
This is true. And I had Sweden helps. I can explain that to you.
Okay. Unless there's like a 25th hour in your day that we don't know about.
No, but the Swedes are super efficient people. And so what they do is, first of all, I had three kids, right? Three little kids at the time. Three kids, and my wife is an academic, right? And so she has her career. She's a biochemist. So there's none of this single job, single career, family nonsense going on. I mean, there's just a dual career, two academics, super busy. My childhood sweetheart, by the way. So we've known each other since childhood. anyway, so married, Sweden, three kids, but the Swedes, what they do, they give you like 400 days parental leave per kid. Paid,
right? Not in the U.S. for sure.
No, exactly. And so, and yes, they produce pretty efficient. You know, well, I mean, Corona has hit badly, as in other places, as we know. But what that does, it creates a situation in which family life and developing a dual career is actually doable. You know, yes, there's hiatus, you know, when you're home with kids. And in fact, I got so bored being home with the first one that this is when I wrote the Field Guide to Understanding Human Error.
Should you say that out loud that you got bored with the first kid?
Well, he was a baby. I'll admit that. No, I love him to bits. But you know, the baby sleeps. You know, so you go, okay, what do I do now? You know, how would wash the windows or something? No. So I was actually in the baby room. So this is really cool. The first Field Guide to Understanding Human Error, right? The one that Todd Conklin picked up a few years later, and then. Mm-hmm. You know, took off with in his stuff. The one I wrote in 2001, published in 2001, was written in Jonathan's baby room. And, you know, I had a little desk set up there. And then so he's in the crib, you know, behind, and he's dozing away. And I'm writing the book, right? And then, you know, and he starts stirring. And I go, not yet. I got this paragraph to finish.
So, he wanted co-author credits is what it was. That's what he was working on at the time.
That's interesting, because who knows, I may write some other things with it, but he's now, what would he be, he's 20, yeah, he would be, he's 20, so that's where the first book was born, literally out of Swedish parental leave, you know, which isn't the intention of parental leave, but, you know, when else do you have the opportunity as a parent to write a book, or as an academic for that matter, because you're too busy with other stuff. So, which is ironic. Anyway, so back to the 737 flying. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think I did borrow a little from the marital bank for that one in terms of time. And so I have to admit that, because the pacing of the training is pretty severe, right? And so and the timing is crap, right? What I mean by that is the simulator slots that you get assigned, you know, 4-hour slots, right? Plus briefing before and after. And so, which may happen in the middle of the night, right? Because, and every time I had to drive to Copenhagen, because that's where it was, which is in another country, right? So across the bridge is another country. So that was quite, yeah, that was a bit of an onslaught. And so, and my wife was wrapping up her PhD at the time. So those are not times to really, you know, borrow against marital credit. It all worked out good. And then I was able to basically tell the airline, which is tickled to have a professor, human factors and safety and author, fly with them. They thought that was a very cool idea. To tell them that I needed to do this part-time after going through my line training. And so, and then I was pretty much able to negotiate with the scheduler what I wanted to do, which is really cool. So the coolest trip was from Copenhagen down to Venice. It's, you know, you show up at 10 o'clock in the morning, which is a gentlemanly hour. You know, it's none of this nonsense of, you know,
5 a.m.
6:30. Oh, 6:30 pushback to fly a bunch of people down to Malaga or some sun destination. You go, why? You know, I mean, you're in this thing. You haven't even had breakfast yet. And it's all, anyway. And you have to remind yourself, I'm doing this because it's fun.
Because you love it. You love it. I mean, yeah. It's something you've been looking at since you were three. So.
Yeah, true. Although I think most pilots would agree that, you know, the infatuation with flying is not necessarily the thing that you experience when you sit there 3 hours into a trip looking at the automation doing all the things, right? And with nothing to look at outside because you're either at night or, I mean, in fact, at some point you seem to always be flying at night. And so, but then, you know, this airline, start descending. And it was actually an airline that encouraged a lot of hand flying, which is why I do it. You know, computers, I have computers in other areas. Yeah, exactly right. So, but driving something by hand that weighs, you know, 65 tons or 60 tons is actually really cool. So you click it off at 15,000 feet and just fly it all the way down. So that made the trip all worth it. And I mean, the longer you hand fly before a landing, typically the better the landing gets, you know, because you really have developed the feel of the thing by then. And so but that's certainly what was interesting about that, Jay, was that the was the position of a co-pilot in an airline that still had a couple of crusty old captains in there. And I recall one incident in which I was flying to a dark, stormy field in the middle of Denmark one evening with a captain whom I'd flown with before and who didn't like professors at all and thought he just could drive this jet by himself. And, the typical role for a co-pilot is gear up, flaps up, shut up. Right. And so, they're still around. And everything we write about CRM, crew resource management and speaking up and co-pilots deciding to remain quiet and then drive themselves into their own death, actually became a lived experience, which renders me to this day not humiliated, but at least really modest about making claims and expecting people to do the right thing in situations like that. Because if someone who talks for a living, who has absolutely no problem blabbing and talking and writing and expressing himself, gets configured into a situation in which he's bullied into silence, then no one is superior to anybody else in this, right? And so what was really cool about the whole thing, though, was it's very different from just blabbing about it. You, as I said, you live the experience. You will be the first at the scene of the accident, right? Which means that it really focuses the mind. And where I point the nose, 189 people are going, right? And they have no say in the matter. And so the ethical implications of that, instead of just being an academic, are huge. And I think have rendered me, if anything, I hope more authentic, more willing to see all kinds of viewpoints. That's an interesting combination of safety, the interest in safety and living it.
Now, do you think that this gives you a different perspective compared to most academics because it gives you an operator perspective as well as an academic perspective because of what you've been through from the airline industry?
In a way, I would hope so. Although I'm in no position to judge the perspective and the experiences and the background that anybody else brings to what they believe or find. But what I do recognize in how I work myself is, and this gets me in trouble quite a few times actually, Jay, is that I'm very sympathetic to the viewpoint of the operator, to the point where I frequently fight with managers and boards about their stultified, limited, arrogant interpretations of work as done on the floor. I'll give you an example. I was working with a company that makes pallets. You know, these things need making as well, and they need repairing. And so there's a huge production pressure. They lack the resources at the time, and all kinds of other things going on. And of course, like all kinds of lines, you know, you've got this in clearing centers or fulfillment centers at Amazon and others. Lots of lines, and lines get stuck. You know, boxes get jammed, and so what do you do? Well, you got to stop the line. You don't want to stop the line because that has all kinds of knock-on consequences that make
money.
Yeah, make a lot of people unhappy, right? And so what do? You crawl onto the line, you unhitch the thing, and boom, it goes again, right? And so, and of course, employers would cry foul and say, oh, you can't do that. You do that, you're fired. Right. And so, so that was the case here. Paddle gets stuck. Guy unjams it. The paddle slams back and breaks his thumb. And this is on video. You see it happen. Poor dude, you know, flop, you see it happen. And so we look at this, right? And I've traced it all out and I've, you know, done the field guide thing. And, you know, so there's, as the story goes, right? Human error is not a cause of trouble. It is a consequence of trouble deeper in the organization, right? And so, true to my own words, I put this before a whole suite of managers of this pellet company. And then the operationally responsible manager, after, you know, listening to what he considered pure drivel and sweet, soft, fuzzy, nonsensical human interest nonsense, just grunts, yeah, but you clearly did the wrong thing. Jay, I lost it. I just lost it. So I try not to get angry because it really is not useful. But I think I'm too well controlled for that. But
hold on. When you say you lost it, what happened in return? What did you? I mean, you don't have to go into specifics, but what was the?
When I say I lost it, what I first did was express very strongly my disappointment. Disappointment and deep impatience with his clear unwillingness to open his mind to a different way of looking at this problem, and that by doing what he was doing and saying what he was saying, all he was doing was asking for the next one, and that we hadn't been talking for an hour and a half to arrive at the point in which it is legitimate to say what he just said. I think it went down like that a little bit. Jay, I don't think it made a damn difference, actually. I think he just folded his arms and set back. And that's my loss, right? And you know, if you're incapable of keeping people in the conversation, then that's my loss.
So when you go back and you take a look at this, of course, it's a learning scenario for you as well as it is for the organization. How did you think, or looking back now, how do you think you could have done it better?
That's a good question. On that particular one, I've actually not
hindsight 2020. I'm not trying to pull that trick.
No. But it's an utterly legitimate question to ask. I don't know in the exact dynamics of the situation what it would have been, but what I have learned is that the main aim in doing this and getting through to people is to keep them engaged in the conversation. If what I do in my impatient reaction to somebody who, like, after an hour and a half still doesn't get it, and clearly wants to posture in front of his colleagues that he's got it all under control and that his people are just bloody idiots, if I, in my reaction to that, somehow make his voice and his viewpoint sound utterly illegitimate, then that's not constructive to the discussion and to the learning moment. And in conflict avoiding cultures, it's even quite embarrassing. People don't like it at all. I mean, being Dutch, we're not conflict avoiding, so I have no trouble with that. But other cultures do. And I'm very aware of that. But I think looking back, I think I should have invited him in a conversation by asking questions. Tell me more about wrong. You know, what would right be? Right? And for example, that could be a question, right? And right when he said, "Oh, you clearly did the wrong thing." Well, tell me about wrong. What would the right thing be if that is wrong? And then move him to a place in which we can start talking about how he sets people up for doing the wrong thing, rather than setting his people up for doing the right thing by constricting their choices available to the point where this is the only legitimate option that people see as available to them. That would be an accomplishment, and that would be nice. So that said, Jay, I'm human too, only, you know, I lose patience. I at some point decide people are not worth investing in. You know, I mean, good God.
Well, no, and I asked the question because there's a couple of different things. I want people to listen as listeners, of course, and myself as too, of, you know, what examples you can give of scenarios that you've had. And I think it's a great thing for us to be able to learn from, especially you going through something similar to that. So I have to ask a question, and of course, this is going to throw some things off. At what point during your career did you say, I have an idea of, I don't know, do you deem it a movie or do you deem it a documentary? How do you look at it? The Just Culture Report. Do you call it what you created? Do you call it
a movie? The Just Culture.
Right.
No, that started as a book, and it started
as a book. I know it's a book, but did you look at, when you said, we're going to do video filming, do you look at it as a documentary or do you look at it as a movie? I've always wondered.
Wow. I should have a chat with my filmmaker. I think
I thought Todd would have prepared you for some of these crazy questions that I ask.
That's right. No, I can tap that. It's cool. I can make something up to answer. But Todd has not done anything. But a movie or a documentary. So what are the, give me the definition of either. And
let's kind of backtrack. When you came up with the idea for the movie, was there already the thought process of something to put on video?
No. In fact, this is a really interesting story. You're getting all the backstories here.
I want to make this different than some of the other interviews that you've done.
That's cool. So because this again has everything to do with my kids. Right? And so we move I'm now living in my seventh country and you learn all kinds of languages and ways of being and eating and cultures and people, which is really nice and lovely and rich about life. And so we moved to this one, to Australia, a few years ago. And then I took with me, an old, cell phone that I bought in Europe. Right. And so, which was sort of a really old model iPhone. Well, it gets older every year for some wacky reason, right? And so Apple wants you anyway. So this phone is still with me, and it does what a phone does, which is call people and get called on.
That's not what people these days expect a phone
to do. Exactly, Jay. So you're almost spoiling the plot here. So I'm calling off this phone and it works. And my kids increasingly see this as a source of utter embarrassment. Right. And so it's not like, I mean, Richard Cook, he uses an old, clamshell flip one, right? Which is just so cool. I'm on this phone and it's not working. Then I'm flying on an airline here with a big kangaroo on the tail that, not as a pilot, but, being ferried from one talk to the next and they turn out to have a Wi-Fi system aboard, and then you can watch movies and documentaries by streaming them. And I go, that's neat. And I look at my phone, and the thing, of course, has no idea. Right? It's utterly incapable of connecting and doing anything. It refused software updates for many years already. So eventually, my kids convinced me to get a new phone. So I get a new phone, and then the newspaper we were reading, in fact, the New York Times stops delivering paper copies across the world. So I want to read it on a screen. I don't want to read it on a screen. I have no choice but to
read it. The illusion of choice is what I call it. The illusion of choice.
Yeah, good on you, man. Yeah. Oh, you can read us everywhere. Yeah, true. But I want to read the New York Times. The New York Times shows up on the phone, and I go, well, if this is how it is, that's a really tiny bloody little screen. That's useless, right? So I need one with a bigger screen. So my kids then convince me to get an iPhone with a big, bigger iPhone. And so, so the first time I take this into this airplane, this new iPhone, I go, oh, let me go watch a documentary. Jay, I'm kidding you not. The first documentary I watch is a French documentary. I forget the name. But it really is about the Rhineland model of managing and changing a world of work from boss men and hierarchy and imposed constraints and orders to one of collaborative decision making, much flatter. And they did this across a number of industries. And so they interview people. I go, man, I should do this with safety differently. I should do this with safety. We're doing all these cool things with Woolworths and with Origin Energy and with Queens and Health. And we're doing all these cool things. And yeah, we're writing about it. But, you know, who reads these academics? Nobody reads anything anymore, right? And so so that's when I engaged the filmmakers. And I think Safety Differently, I think, came out in 2017. It was the first one. I mean, that also shows you when I got finally into an age in which a phone did more than a phone. But I have books to write. You know, who's got time to watch a phone? Yeah. So anyway, so and then was it? Yes, 17. And then very quickly after that, I got a call from the UK. Right. And so so that film comes out. Then I get a call from, well, not, I get an email from Amanda Oates, who is the HR manager of Mercy Care. So, I mean, they are mental health NHS, so National Health Service Trust in the area of Liverpool, right? So covering population about like 5 million people. It's a pretty big organization. And she writes me just a few lines and say, hi, it's us. We've been using your book on Just Culture, the third edition, which deals with restorative justice, and we have some amazing results. Right, we just wanted to let you know. And if ever there is a chance for you to be over in Liverpool, we'd love to show you around. That was it. And so I write back back and forth a few times, and this very quickly this invitation morphs into something more. More not formal, but real. But I say, you know, I'm happy to come to Liverpool to come take a look, but I will bring a camera crew because I'm thinking, man, I really enjoyed making that previous one. This sounds like it's, you know, this is cinema. You know, this could be really good. And so Martin Jacobson tagged along my filmmaker and did an amazing job. Now, does that answer the question whether it's a movie or a documentary?
Well, you refer to it as a film.
As a film.
So
right?
You put me in the middle there. So that was kind of
interesting. There you go. It's a film. We made a film. We shot the film. There you go.
But I see where some of the inspiration came about. So that I really appreciate you saying that. Now, there's some different things that I have noticed online that are coming about that you're about to start doing. So I noticed that you're getting into the world of virtual sessions. About to come up.
Yeah.
How are you feeling about this, especially in this new area of COVID-19?
So how do I feel about the virtual sessions? There is nothing that can substitute for the lived sense of the energy, the vibe in a room, right? Where people get the light, you see ideas grow, you see faces scrunched up and really struggling with a practical or moral question that comes out of the things that you're discussing. And one of the things that gives me a lot of meaning in life is this sense of holding the room in my hand. I mean, I don't want to sound arrogant or possessive or controlling with that, but just the sense of, you're so in the flow. You're so in the moment. You're so, and I love that.
Right.
And
it's the energy of the room that kind of guides the direction on where you're going.
That is exactly right.
And let's just be realistic in this particular format. Even now, as we're speaking now, unless we're engaging and I'm looking at the screen and you're looking at your screen, it's kind of difficult to see where we're going. And it's difficult sometimes when somebody gets that aha moment of, I get what you're saying. Be able to doing it virtually. Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of crazy, so I'm locked up in a room and talk to myself all the time. So I'm a little bit okay with it.
Yeah, and the silly thing about you, Jay, is you don't even have to be looking at a screen to be talking to yourself.
Right. Right? I mean, right.
Man, that's psychological. But you know, you're right. I mean, so the experience of having a screen full of little squares with faces is just not the same thing. It's not the same thing. It's a poor substitute. However, there is a huge advantage to it. And that is that the the reach can increase and diversify dramatically. And what I mean by that is people don't have to travel. They don't have to be part of a particular organization that either invited me or organized a conference or, you know, in order to be there and be part of the conversation. This is super low threshold, low price, low cost, low threshold. And it's really cool when I see who's signing up, Jay, man, it'd be radio hosts like you. It's maritime rescue volunteers from somewhere around the Atlantic. It's a firefighter in, I forget the country. It's a mountaineer outdoors instructor in New Zealand. It's a nurse in the UK. It's a construction executive in the US. And you go, oh, I mean, but does that diversity not present real issues with getting a discussion going? Well, first of all, we'll see. But I don't think it will, actually. I think that sort of diversity, when you talk about things that really are of generic concern, how do you deal meaningfully with the aftermath of an incident that could have hurt somebody really badly, right? That's a question that goes for all of them. And they all have some moral stake in dealing with that question. How do you deal with the increasing bureaucratization of frontline work? There is hardly any world in which that is not happening, right? So they all share that concern. How do you interpret many questions that we could come up with, but what I have found, you know, because of course I've racked up a whole bunch of experience teaching online, given that the universities across the world have very quickly had to adopt that model, is that a discussion, whereas it is possible, is not something that you can either let spontaneously erupt or let, as you said before, let it be created by the vibe and the energy of the room and a softly guiding hand as you can do that live. Here, I have found that you have to be, as an instructor, a little bit more structured, which, right, walking through ideas and Sarah, first we're going to talk about this, right? And we'll get some questions and ideas and then some examples, and we'll have some things around that. Then we're going to talk about this, and then we'll talk about that, and then eventually we end up here. So, you know, just culture, whatever you want to do is walk people through the history. Where does this start, right? Why are people even concerned about it? Who starts writing about it? Then what is it about those ideas that really don't work or start working against us, right? In terms of the retributive just culture, this the nonsensical idea that you can just divvy up behavior into errors and risk taking and negligence or something, you know, this utterly bizarre McDonaldization of just culture, as if it's an algorithm that you just run behavior through and boom, the answer pops out. You know, it's I shake my head in disbelief that people would commit to something like that. So I'm editorializing my own story here,
Here's the thing too. You're doing three different sessions. So it's not like you're doing three back to back that are the same thing, which a lot of people are doing, but you're doing three totally different sessions.
So that's right. Just culture. And then there's safety differently or doing safety differently. And then the third one, which is foundations of safety science in half a day. So that's really cool. Well, they're all really cool, but so I'm going to talk about foundation of safety science because I want to talk about that. But first, the real challenge, Jay, you might believe this, but I write so much, you know, and so, I mean, I rail and argue against paperwork, and all I do is produce a lot of it myself. You know? So it's, but I write so many books and because I have ideas and I, you know, and these, anyway, so every year there's a new book and I go, man, how, at least over the last decade or so. And I go, how can I sort of coagulate all of that stuff that's in those books, half of which I don't remember because I don't read them. I write them. You know? And so how can I coagulate that into meaningful bite-sized online deliveries? And so that was quite a struggle. So, I started talking to some ex-students and other people around me going, you know, what would work, right? And they basically came back and said, you know, well, the brands would be Just Culture, it would be Safety Differently, right? Because, you know, you're pretty much overlapping with those brands. And then, so do those. And then I decided, yeah, okay, well, I'll do those. But then I really wanted to do for everyone out there, my last university class, which was, you know, the Foundation of Safety Science. Well, students don't get it in half a day.
They would love that. They'd be like, okay, cool. let's take the abridged course.
No, they wouldn't because they love listening to me.
They just want the credits quicker.
Of course they wanted it half a day. Right? Don't make me read the textbook, for God's sake. Right? Just give it to me in half a day.
That'd be a very Andy Kaufman move of you if you actually read directly out of the textbook.
But you don't get it done in half a day. I have read some of my other books, right? They're audio books, right? Not the textbook. You can't make an audiobook out of a textbook, Jay. That's going to put everyone to sleep, right? That's going to be so boring.
Well, I'm also in the world of audiobook creation, there are some people that do the textbooks into an audiobook, and I'm not going to disagree with what you said. I'll just put it that way.
Well, I'm willing to look at different models of how to audiobook a textbook. And so in some sense, I found it a terrible book to write. It came out good, but I think. You're writing about other people's ideas. Right. And, I'm finding myself building on those ideas and disagreeing and agreeing. I go, I want to write about my ideas. What's all this nonsense writing about other people's ideas for 100 years? Not writing 100 years, but about 100 years of ideas. And so, the really cool thing is, right, is that, so what happens in that sort of course, I field tested it, that one, in the 3-hour version, and it works really cool. People coming back say, my company does ICAMs all the time, right? And you go, okay. And they had no idea that ICAM, right? This, I don't even know what it stands for. But it's an incident investigation method that lots of organizations use for the lack of knowing any better, not because it delivers any meaningful results, because it doesn't. And they had no idea that this is based in late 1980s ideas about, Newtonian cause effect as depicted by the Swiss cheese, which itself is a 50-year later replication of the domino model from the early 1930s, Heinrich, in which, just imagine, right, the dominoes, they have eyes, right, and you line them up, and then the eyes in the dominoes 50 years later become holes in layers of cheese. But the basic Newtonian assumptions underneath the model are still the same, right? Cause effect, something small cannot lead to something large. One thing has to lead to the next. It's completely linear. And at the end of it all, in order for the whole model to work, you need an unsafe act by a frontline person at the sharp end to screw it up. And so these assumptions and even phrases and words are common across these two models and then find their way 50 years later again in an ICAM that some unwitting safety person applies in an investigation because that's what they were told to do. Now, to be part of the revelation, which is really trivial for a professor because, you do this for a living, right? And you find out where these ideas come from and lay out the genealogy of them. But to be part of the revelation of somebody saying, wow, I had no idea that by me doing this ICAM, I am importing assumptions about human performance, about how organizations work and safety and it gets broken and made in a company, I'm importing assumptions from basically 1920s late industrial revolution America in how I look at this in 2020 in my company today. And that is so empowering, right? And it's just one example, right? It's just one example. Other examples, drifting into failure, right? It's not something I made up. I wrote a book.
You wrote a book about it, for sure.
But the idea of an organization slowly but gradually unwittingly renegotiating what it sees as acceptable risk and making small steps toward the fringes of what is sustainable is not new, right? The first really explicit work in that is from the 1970s, and which is really cool, right? Barry Turner, he starts to look at this, and he was the first one in Cardiff in the UK to write a book that shows that accidents really should not be understood as engineering issues, but as administrative, bureaucratic, human organizational issues. And and that happened after the 1960s, and it had to happen after the 1960s because until then, Jay, right, and I can explain all these things, right? That until then, you can see the world as a believer in modernism, and if we build stuff well, we will all get better. We can buy all kinds of consumer goods, and then all of a sudden, during the 60s, you get this awareness of lots of things growing, by the way, right? And altered mind states around stuff, but and people start seeing, hang on, this all of these great things that we're building, nuclear power plants and chemical plants, and give us all these great things like plastic, they can blow up in the night. And it can create really big trouble for us, right? And so there's an ugly underbelly to all of this, which generates all kinds of awareness in the 1970s, which then gives rise or creates the cultural conditions for the appearance of this work of drifting into failure, which, again, is not a word or a phrase that Barry Turner used. But so it goes back to that. Then you go back to, you know, iceberg thinking and trying, you know, this completely misguided idea. And you go, well, where does it come from? As people probably know but might not know, you know, you find out that Heinrich, an insurance man, not a scientist, right, whose scientific method, by the way, right, was four lines long, the method description, four lines.
It's a perfect four lines. Who needs more?
peer reviewers in journals today need more, right, in order to meet the criteria of scientific right. method, but never mind, right? It was an insurance man who had, of course, an agenda, which is to save his company money, right? And so you want to reduce the number of claims coming in. Now, the so-called base of the triangle consists of incidents without any consequences, right? And so, and you go, how could he have known? Because, you know, his basic material was insurance claims, closed claim files. And if there's no harm, there's no claim. If there's no claim, you have no data. So it turns out, the deeper you dig, it turns out that he made it up. He just made it up. There is actually no, literally no basis for the triangle, right? And so once you get into, and this is, you know, this is not only what science should do, this is what any critical mind should do, you know, is ask very fundamental questions about the assumptions underneath somebody's claim, somebody's model, you know, and then you reveal all kinds of things that not necessarily make you a disbeliever, because as, you know, Levi Strauss, a very famous anthropologist, would say, is it still good to think with, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it can still be good to think with, but it can also be really destructive and stupid to think with because it gets you to do the wrong thing. As we know, you know, counting incidents and injuries is absolutely not predictive of you blowing stuff up in the night.
Now, right? do you look at this also as well as it, at this point, this triangle, well, let's just call it a dumb model, has gotten people to safety differently or safety 2.0 or however people want to deem it because they're noticing that it is not compatible with work on how it should be done?
I get asked that a version of that question a lot, also in terms of, for example, just culture or even, you know, understanding human error, where people go, oh, but shouldn't we first be doing HVACs, you know, the human right. factors, whatever it's called, the Chappelle Weekman colleagues model, in order to get where you are, should we not first work through retributive just culture with these wacky categories of honest mistakes and risk-taking behavior and recklessness?
And I'm not saying that we should go through it, but I think, do you agree that it has led people to get to safety differently? To an extent. And it's an opinion question, so there is
no, it's an empirical question. I mean, is there, do I have empirical data that says that that's the case? Yes, I do. This is true. Sorry, what I was trying to do in answering the question, Jay, was saying I find it morally objectionable that we should be misguiding people before getting them to a place that is probably more constructive for them and their organization and more morally uplifting, right? Than just but I think where people, if I look at the if I can call it fan mail, it's very often the dead end that comes out of utter frustration with the way things are done in people's organizations to that point. Either when it comes to responding justly to incidents or cluttering bureaucracy, the disempowerment of people on the front line with increasing compliance requirements. It's those frustrations and vexations and that get people to start lifting their nose and their view and trying to find other ways to do this stuff.
So you mentioned something there. You mentioned fan mail. So I would imagine because you receive fan mail, you also receive hate mail. Just an assumption that would happen.
It's actually interestingly. A couple of things. I don't receive a lot of hate mail.
Oh, okay.
Most hate mail. Not directly. Mm-hmm. Because that takes courage and identification.
And a lot of people don't have that. No, and the reason that I bring this up because, of course, I look at different social medias because of what I do
and all that kind of
stuff. Now, there is a guy that is convinced that safety differently is called safety differently because of your initials. And he posts this online all the time.
How cool is that?
And I was like,
I had no idea.
I never put the association, but I was like, that doesn't sound right. And I was like, if I have the source here, I have to ask the question.
SD. Yeah. It's also standing for Sicherheitsdienst, which was a Nazi bureaucracy.
Well, being as I threw you off with that, I'm going to assume that that's not the answer. I just wanted to make sure that I had that point clear because I didn't think it's
Jay, for that. I have a wife who cuts down my ego back to regular size every day. And so I have no need for any of that. No, but it's interesting. I hadn't made that association. That's fascinating. Well, good on the person who
I did. Well, I was amazed because I was like, I had never seen that. And I was like, wow. I was like, I have to ask that.
But the key thing is, right, to make this claim and stand for it without asking the source, because I don't recall having been asked this, but that's all right. I have learned very quickly, Jay, that social media is the monetization of vituperation and hate and resentment. And I refuse to participate. And so I don't read. I'm not on LinkedIn. I'm not on Facebook. And so let people say what they want to say. I really do not care. Well, I mean, sometimes I care not that I care about the corruption of my ideas and
there's a lot of people that corrupt your ideas. Let's be realistic.
As a scientist, you do care about that little bit, the questioning of my integrity and character undoubtedly. And so, but I don't want to be part of it because I have learned that in the more serious way of doing this, right. And, you know, peer reviews is something that by which science lives, right. And quality control is very, very stringent in that regard. Bad reviews always make me feel worse than good reviews make me feel good. And so it never sort of equals or balances out. So I'm not going to go look for bad reviews. Mm-hmm. I will look for improvement opportunities and feedback. But my sense is, Jay, you know, more people are not talking about this stuff yet than are talking about it.
Right.
And so it's all good. It's all good.
So what
we
do you
need this conversation?
What do you see?
We cannot keep doing what we're doing because we'll keep getting what we're getting, which is not good enough.
Right. Not good enough for sure. So what are you seeing right now with everything going on with COVID? What is your thought process and what are you writing about now?
No, good. The book that'll come out hopefully in the beginning of 21, got a growth spurt because of the lockdown. So I could finish it. But also because it is inspired in part by what we see go down. And that is, part of a larger discontent with free market thinking and what the detractors call neoliberalism, right? The idea that free markets are the solution to everything, that the smaller government is, the better we can deal with all kinds of societal challenges, right? That was the idea that Thatcher and Reagan introduced back in the 80s, and was certainly necessary to deal with some encrusted entitlements and issues and at the time, for sure. But in that book, what I do is I trace, and I don't think anybody has done that yet, I trace the very clear connection between free markets and unfree people on the one hand, and free markets and fragile systems on the other hand. And so free markets have some great advantages. However, they counterintuitively produce unfree people by introducing a whole host of new compliance demands, rules to follow, checklists to do, which didn't exist when, for example, government still owned that particular activity, right? But the government sells it off, then it becomes a market full of contractors, full of liability concerns, full of boards, full of manslaughter laws, and all of a sudden you've got this mushrooming of compliance demands that can be traced back to free markets entering into that activity. And so, really interestingly, the paradoxical idea is that free markets lead to unfree people. Now, back to COVID, what we also see is that there's a clear link between free market thinking and introducing free markets to, for example, healthcare. Electricity distribution, other things, that creates a new fragility, vulnerability, brittleness in these systems that are supposed to deliver these services. Because ultimately they don't meet Adam Smith's ideals of what a free market should be. For example, if you're sick, you're sick. You're not a consumer on Adam Smith's free market that has a choice. You know, do I want care or not? You know, well, you want care, but the question it becomes, can you afford it?
Right.
Which is inhumane, immoral, really a blemish on any society that organizes itself that way, right? Where you have to make choices like that as if you were a consumer with free choice. And so we make increasing, and the argument is more complex than that, obviously. So but you have to read the book, which nobody will, because nobody reads anything anymore. So I have to make an audio book,
of course.
So anyway, so yes, there is a definite infusion of COVID experiences in that. You know, if we whittle down government and make it essentially a hollowed out, slimmed down version of itself in which but lots of competent people are bullied away because they no longer see it as a reasonable place to work, then you're asking for the kind of trouble that you get in. Right. And so I mean, that's perhaps too moralizing, but and a very short shrift version of the argument. But that most people can probably recognize something in. So the other thing is, the only thing is I run a research lab. Right. And I never had the idea that the research lab could be so vulnerable to a simultaneous nosedive in all industries from which we get research money. Normally, I mean, mining goes down, but then another industry goes up. Oil and gas goes down, but then something else works out. Right? And so all of a sudden, COVID comes and everything tanks. You know, that was a failure mode that we really hadn't planned for. And I don't think we're alone in that. But however, we've got lots of interesting work from healthcare that actually has realized that bureaucratic top-down responses to a surprising, very uncertain, quickly escalating pandemic are not useful, and that a much deeper understanding of complexity and probability and emergence is necessary for them to train their frontline clinical leaders in order to meet the challenges of a pandemic like this. And to be at the forefront of something like that, is really exciting.
So as you look at the big picture and the big scale, do you think that the impact that this has had on so many different industries will change the way that we do business going forward in the future on how the systems are built out?
And part of me is optimistic, but part of me is pessimistic. You know, I see people are saying this about aviation, for example, right? I mean, we shouldn't be flying to a sunny destination for $29, right? I mean, at the expense of the environment, this is all bad. Why are we doing this, right? And so We shouldn't be shipping, we shouldn't have supply lines drawn thinly across the entire globe, burning heavy diesel oil in trucking containers across the world in order to, you know, put things together that become our consumer goods. We should have more onshore manufacturing and things like that. All of those voices were legitimated through the early months of COVID. How much of that are we seeing sustained now, Jay? I'm a little pessimistic there, right? People, for example, companies with supply lines deeply into China, and that is really organized competently around this, you know, despite everything political. It's so easy to say, it's too hard to find a meaningful, cost-effective alternative to this. You see the same in flying. Right? People are desperate to get out of their lockdown, you know, so let's go flying and, oh, they're really there on special. Let's go, you know, $29. Let's go to the sun. Let's go to Florida where you already are. But, you know, so, and you know, if you live in Montreal, who can blame you? Right. So are we really going to change? But you should really be interviewing other people. But you know, there's a whole science around this, right? Right. Historical and sociological work that shows that yes, pandemics in the longer run have significant consequences for society. I just mentioned one: the Black Death in Europe, for example, had a significant impact on emancipation, well, such as it was, female emancipation and workforce participation, because there was no choice, mm-hmm. right? Had that not happened, who knows? You know, we may not have had female suffrage in the 1920s or whenever it came in the U.S., right? I'm making this up.
You're right.
In the big stretch of history, pandemics definitely leave their trace. In the immediate response to it, the signs are not entirely immediately encouraging.
Right, because people go, there's no way out based on public opinion is really how that ends up working, is how they look at it. Well, I appreciate you taking the time on coming onto the show. Please don't let this be a one and only. I would love for you to come on multiple times in the future, especially when your book's about to come out, if you do have the opportunity of doing so. I know that you're extremely busy for the most part. I think it almost took me a year to get you onto the show. I'm not just saying.
A year?
Yeah, wow. I had emailed you a long time ago, but I know you're a busy person. And I had talked to Rob Fisher. I had talked to Todd. I talked to Ivan Popoliti. And everybody's like, we're going to talk to him. We're going to get you on. And I was like, let me try one more time. I even went through Sam and said, how did you do it? What was the magic trick? But I really appreciate you taking the time on doing this. Now, if people want to get more information about the things you're doing, where could they go to find out more info?
SydneyDecker.com, right? So, and you got to spell the name correctly. So it's Sydney, so the traditional English way, not that I'm English, but S-I-D-N-E-Y, right?
Right.
Decker, D-E-K-K-E-R, because I'm Dutch, right? SydneyDecker.com. That's it. That's where you go. There's lots of papers. All my books are there. And you can sign up for the workshops.
Yes. Absolutely.
I'd love to see you, your listeners there.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you coming on.
Happy to do it, Jay.
Well, this brings this episode of the Jay Allen Show to an end. Hopefully you had the opportunity to learn a lot today, just as I did during our interview today with Sydney Decker. Make sure that you take a look at Sydney's website at sydneydecker.com. There you'll have the opportunity to sign up for his workshops that he'll be hosting over the next few months. His workshops start going into effect starting August the 27th. That will be Building a Restorative Just Culture Workshop. On September the 3rd, Doing Safety Differently Workshop. That's also at 7 a.m. Australian time. And then on September the 10th, Foundations of Safety Science at 7 a.m. Australian time. Well, thank you for taking a listen to this episode of The Jay Allen Show. If you're interested in the HOP 101 class that's taking place on July 29th of 2020, feel free to go to safetyfm.io. There are still tickets available. This will bring another episode of The Jay Allen Show to an end.
Thank you for always being the best part of Safety FM, and that is the listener. Safety FM is the home of real safety talk. We'll be back with another episode of the Jay Allen Show before too long. Goodbye for now.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
So do you feel like you're missing out on what everyone is starting to do now, that live streaming thing, and you don't know where to start or what to do? I have the resource and the information to provide to you in regards on how you can stream onto 40 social media platforms all at one time. Yes, that's 440 social media platforms all at one time. All you'll need to do is go to safetyfm.com/one. That's safetyfm.com/one. That's O-N-E. So just in case. And you'll be able to start live streaming just like you're hearing people starting to do right now, up to 40 social media platforms.